you know, it's all well and good to be very snobby about it and get nature at people, but people have busy lives. They have dogs, they have children, they have a disability. So we need to come up with solutions to fix that. So that's where the challenge is. We need to sort of find an alternative which will replace the plastic. And that's where the challenge comes.
Welcome to The Underground, the podcast for garden sector professionals, where we discover the trailblazers and innovators who are shaping the future of garden care in the UK. From plants to products, wildlife and the environment, we'll dig deep to bring you the inside story. So without further ado, let's get down and dirty.
So on today's podcast, Phil and I are joined by the lovely Charlotte Howard. She is a garden designer, has her own company called Capability Charlotte. She has an RHS Masters of Horticulture. That's not gardening, it's horticulture, and a national diploma in horticulture. But one of the main reasons we've got Charlotte on today, well, there's two reasons. She's also the founder of a Facebook group called Women in Gardening Network, fondly known as WIGS. And this has over 3,000 members. And she's not shy on putting her views forward. And last year she was seen on Gardener's World with Aaron Anderson talking about why she wants artificial turf banned. She has a campaign, which is hashtag Time for Turf. Not only that, she's also very recently started a campaign highlighting the problems that women find getting decent, comfortable and affordable workwear. So, Charlotte, it's lovely to meet you.
Hello, Kate, and hello, Phil.
So, Charlotte, can you give us a bit of background about yourself? Tell us how you got into horticulture and what your role is now.
Yeah, so I have quite a varied background, a sort of didactic career and a portmanteau career, as they say. So I started out in retail management in my 20s and did lots of eccentric things in my spare time. I was the first fully licensed boxing MC. I was a Marilyn Monroe impersonator. I was in a girl band.
Wow.
I did all of that sort of thing. And then my parents had a beautiful garden. It used to be open on the National Garden Scheme. And it was always something I loved to do as a hobby. Both my parents were self-employed, my father an architect, my mother an antique dealer and interior designer, and they were both designers and creatives, and it was just something I'd always envied, that they had, their time was their own. I quickly realised at the age of 29 that I was pretty much unemployable. I don't like being told what to do. So I decided to make my hobby, my passion, my career. So I went to gardening college and did my national diploma and started my business Capability Charlotte from there. So I haven't looked back. I think horticulture, other than gardening, because it's all encompassing, it is a fantastic career to be in because it can take you wherever you are. So I've experienced some ill health in the last 5 years. So I've been able to give up gardening and become a consultant. So yeah, it's a fabulous career. I just wish it was better paid and more comfortable clothing.
Brilliant. So do you find that all that kind of design and artistic creative backgrounds helped you with being a garden designer and a consultant?
Without a doubt, Kate, my design background completely informs everything I do. I've got a love of history and a love of form. Going and being dragged around lots of stately homes as a child, you see lots of gardens and you just absorb it. It comes in as osmosis. So yeah, I think it makes me a more interesting person, hopefully.
So we're just going to talk about sort of sustainability, native planting, very hot topics within the garden industry have been for a few years. And can you tell me how you address these subjects in what you do?
Yeah, I think it's really important to tackle sustainability in everything we do. I think as designers, we have a responsibility to do so because we're losing our own natural wild areas. Our nature reserves are dwindling. I think it's 70% or something like that. Mm-hmm. So gardens are becoming an essential wildlife corridor. And although they are essentially a piece of artifice, they're artificial in that kind of way, we still need to make sure that the gardens are there to attract wildlife. It's quite funny, actually. I was going back through my old garden designs because I'm doing a garden club talk about my life as a garden designer, and I was going back. My very, very first garden design was a wildlife garden, so it's obviously something that's been important to me. I think things are changing. I think the Society of Garden Designers has picked up with that. You know, long may it continue, but I think there are quite a few designers out there that do not put nature and also water conservancy and the use of water front and center into their designs. There's too much hard landscaping, that kind of thing. So whenever I create gardens, I think about the practicality for the clients first. How are they going to use it? And I think, and almost as equal, is how is nature going to use it? The two must be in symbiosis, otherwise it just doesn't work.
Thank you. So Phil, you have a question.
Yeah, so it's picking up on that, really. Generally, looking at the sort of garden and landscaping industry, where do you see that the sector is falling down from an environmental perspective?
Gosh, where are they falling up? The sector I find incredibly frustrating, and I think some of the organisations that run the sectors, I'm going to mention Bali, I'm going to mention them, because they are continually awarding gardens that have plastic grass in them, for example. They're awarding things that are heavily hardscaped. They're promoting porcelain, composite decking, all of that sort of thing. And they, you know, I've lobbied them, I've spoken to them, I've met them in person, and they are refusing to change. We're still, the big dirty secret about horticulture is the amount of plastic in our industry. You know, we all give out the feeling of being, you know, at one with nature, yet you order some plants and they come decked in plastic. And yeah, I find that really frustrating, because at my end, I'm doing my very best. I'm putting nature front and center into all of my designs. And then I place a plant order and I get this sea of plastic that I have to now deal with. Things like, you know, the products that come, the little pellets, they have microplastics are wrapped around them. So we're basically pouring microplastics into our soil. And I think that's it. We ignore the importance of improving our soil at our peril.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. I mean, there are some quite new developments that I've seen, you know, things like plant pots that are made from wool and that sort of thing. So, you know, if those sorts of developments and innovations can be replicated and rolled out cost effectively, you know, that's the sort of thing which I think could be a game changer for the industry, couldn't it?
Yes. And of course, there is supply and demand. And I also concern that there seems to be quite a heavy emphasis, obviously, with the changeover from peat to non-peat. You know, there are very few decent alternatives to peat-free compost. There seems to be a lot of emphasis on coir, which is equally unsustainable, in my opinion. Comes from a foreign country, and it's a great huge amount of water used in coir. So I think you're right. You have to think about, you know, all of these. There are innovations. I posted it on LinkedIn about a product that I received full of plastic, and I had loads of responses from companies saying, "Oh yeah, we do all this. We do this at cardboard, and we've approached all these companies, and we've heard nothing from them." So. Yes, it's quite hard to make such major changes within a company. I understand that.
It takes time. Having worked for a big company myself, I do know it takes time.
The clocks take time to turn.
And it's cost, but there are changes happening. They're just a bit slower than I think we'd like them. I do know that within plant food, especially the pellets, most now are the plastic's been taken out.
It's good to know.
But then what happens is you then get consumers complaining. So it's such a tough one, especially with the peat-free, where consumers complain. And I know coir is definitely, a couple of companies I know don't use any coir because of that very reason. You're just replacing one problem with another environmental problem.
Absolutely, and I agree. And it's, you know, it's all well and good for me to moan at these companies, but if I can't come up with a, you know, what do you suggest, Charlotte? Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just do better, please.
Kate, in her introduction there, mentioned that you're running a campaign to ban or sort of reduce artificial turf. Ban? Good. Okay, good to clarify that. So to ban artificial turf. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting story how I came to this slightly deranged part of my life. I actually had plastic grass, I will admit. I am a reformed drug addict, as they say. Not really a drug addict. drug addict, reformed plastic grass addict. So I live near Bath, and they installed it in the shopping centre in Bath, Easy Grass. I give them another name. And I remember raving about it because this was in the early noughties where we just didn't know any different. And I was still at college at the time. And I just thought, what a great product. It doesn't look like the stuff in butchers' windows. It's got little bits of dead grass. I thought, it's amazing. I thought, oh, I'll get some of that. And I can't believe it. Not only did I have plastic grass, but I had it underneath my hot tub. Two of the most awful things you can have. I don't possess either now, I hasten to add. And yeah, it's one of the biggest regrets of my life, buying that 2 meter by 2 meter patch of plastic grass. But I'm kind of glad I did it. So I shared it anyway on social media, and somebody just called me out on it and said, do you know how crap that is for the environment, Charlotte? And I said, well, it's only a bit of plastic. And they explained to me, and, you know, I sort of was a bit annoyed at first, but like I do, I went home and obsessively researched it and then just sort of realized how terrible it is. And when you think about it, I already really hate weed control memory, and I already hated that when I was at college because you just see it destroys the soil beneath. And actually, this is exactly the same kind of thing, but worse. So I kept that bit of plastic grass until I moved home and then fobbed it off on the new owners. But I kept it because it was actually really good to show how awful it got, because weeds would grow on it, moss would grow on it, cats would do their business on it. So actually, I did use it as a kind of case study, I suppose, for want of a better description. So I came to it from that, really, and then probably a combination of ADHD and massive obsessiveness, I sort of become more and more obsessed with getting the stuff banned. And I found, you know, I've been speaking to quite a lot of really good experts. Dr. Kyla Bennett over in America is an incredibly expert on the dangers of the PFAS chemicals, which it gives out. And you just realize how we're poisoning our wildlife and our children. So, yeah.
I mean, I think the use of artificial grass from a consumer's point of view, you know, quite often now they're looking for a quick fix. So especially in the garden, absolutely. And you know, everything is, they need the hack.
Yes, they do.
They need something to get to the end result. They don't want to put the effort in.
Yes.
You know, it's like learning the guitar or whatever, you know, they want to get to the end result. They want to be on the stage and performing. They don't want to do the hours of practice.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I can see why the attraction of artificial grass can be for people. What are some of the things that you think a designer or consumers can take on board?
Can we first of all sort of discuss the attractions, actually, because it's a very interesting point that you've brought up.
Of course.
Because we need to find out why are people choosing plastic grass first before we can then think of different solutions. Because as a designer, we are a solution-based business. So people will come to me with a problem and I have to find a solution. So as a designer, I approached it and say, why are people choosing plastic grass? And a lot of people, you know, I look out, I'm in a new build, I look out for all the tiny little postage stamp gardens around me. People have kids and dogs, and they just, the soil is so bad. You can see why people make that decision, because as you so rightly said, it, Phil, it is a quick fix. But it is all it is. It's like putting a Band-Aid on top of the problem, really. It doesn't actually fix the key, which is soil. And it's also a status symbol as well. It's, people say it's because it's low maintenance, but it's not actually low maintenance. You have to clean it, you have to hoover it, all of that sort of stuff. So we need to then, because we, you know, it's all well and good to be very snobby about it and get nature at people, but people have busy lives. They have dogs, they have children, they have disability. So we need to come up with solutions to fix that. So that's where the challenge is. We need to sort of find an alternative which will replace the plastic. And that's where the challenge comes. I do actually have my Time for Turf report, which is available on my website, capabilitycharlotte.com.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Which goes through all of the various arguments for plastic grass. And I hopefully come up with a cogent argument against plastic grass. Yes, it is low maintenance, but it's not no maintenance. So every garden will require maintenance. Now, my messy patch outside has a small lawn. I mow it 4 times a year because I'm lazy and I really hate doing it. So I would say that my garden is probably fairly low maintenance. I don't scarify it and do all the aeration you're supposed to do. It is fine. Obviously, I'm very lucky. I don't have kids or children, just 2 recalcitrant cats. But so I think 4 times a year mowing for 20 minutes each time is, yeah, pretty good. if you were to have artificial grass or plastic death carpet, as I prefer to call it, because I don't think it is grass. If you were to have plastic death carpet, you'll have to wash that. So every time your animal decides to defecate on said grass, the smell is just, I don't know if you've ever smelt plastic grass.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so you'll have to wash that away. Whereas if it was on real grass, you just have to, you know, scoop it up and the back, it, you know, the organisms within the soil eat all the bacteria. So it's actually more hygienic, which people think is weird. People find nature a bit scary,
yes.
which is another issue. Then you have to brush it up. So Easygrass, for example, do offer a maintenance service, which is £250 a quarter.
Wow.
To brush up and clean your grass. Because like all carpets, the pile flattens after a while.
Yeah.
You can't have a barbecue on the grass. You can't drop any wine on the grass because you've got to clean that up. You can't have a fag and drop your fag on the grass because you'll get a hole. All of those sort of things. So the maintenance aspect is a fallacy, which is, you know, quite easy to burst that bubble. But the easiest bubble to burst is the cost. So it is to have a properly laid, obviously you could go down to, let's mention Wix, for example, and get some crappy old grass from there and flop it on and hope for the best. But that's just going to blow away in the first storm. To have it properly laid, you need to have an aggregate subbase, which is basically crushed limestone. You have to have possibly sand or grano, depending on whether you've got animals or not. You have to have I've just been watching them do it in the house next door. You have to have timber edging. You have to batten it all down. It's a, you know, 2 or 3 days work. And it costs for a 50 meter square lawn, which is your kind of average. Most of the new build gardens are about 50 meter square, 10 by 5. It will cost you £3,000.
Wow.
To lay a good quality artificial lawn. £3,000.
That's a lot, isn't it?
And that's not one of the top flight ones. You know, you could be looking at 5 or 6 if you have the Easygrass Mayfair range or whatever. The first option would be to get a robo mower. I mean, I've actually had a look online and I could find a refurbished one for £300. You could have a top flight one. Even the posh ones are £1,500 and then that's
it.
Or you could hire a gardener. So a gardener rate sort of should be from £20, between £20 and £35. So looking at a basic mowing gardener, not a skilled gardener, would be about £20 an hour. So if you're looking at the mowing season, maybe 34 weeks max, if that, one a week. Basically, your gardener could come and mow your lawn for the lifespan of a plastic death carpet. So plastic death carpet lies about 15 years, if that.
That's amazing.
But it only lasts 15 years if you maintain it. If you don't maintain it, it'll last 5 to 10.
That's such an interesting statistic that, you know, if you're someone that lives on their own, you've got someone to chat to.
Well, that's it. I was a maintenance gardener for 15 years until I got ill. And yeah, I was mostly older ladies that I used to go and look after because they wanted another female in the garden. And yeah, I'd go and do errands for them. They'd give me the shopping list or they'd message me so I can get some milk on the way. I'd often be the only person they'd see all week. Many, many times. I can't tell you how many times, you know, I've knocked on the door and they've not answered and they've been on the floor and I've had to call an ambulance and stay with them. So there's all of these things. I mean, that's another social aspect.
It's another episode.
But my friend Katrina from Bath Garden Design, you described herself as the fourth emergency service or something. And yeah.
No, it's true. It's absolutely true.
Yeah, because people say, oh, but disabled people need their independence, and that just boils my what's-it, because as a disabled person myself, please don't speak for me.
Yeah.
And I'd be quite happy to employ somebody. We have a cleaner here because I really hate cleaning. And I'm not well enough to do it. I don't feel that I'm less of a person. I've given someone a job and, you know, he does a lovely job.
So could you imagine any situation where artificial turf would be needed?
No.
None at all.
Sorry, that was a very short. No, I cannot see any situation where I personally, as a designer, cannot see any situation where plastic death carpet is a solution. There's always an elegant solution. Have clover, have tapestry lawns. Tapestry lawns are very fashionable at the moment.
So with a tapestry lawn, quite interesting. I think I saw a photograph of one the other day. What's the maintenance like of something like that?
So yes, tapestry lawns were invented by a man called Professor Lionel Smith. So if you're at all interested, he's got a very dry book out on it. One day I want to sort of paraphrase it and make it a bit more user-friendly. So the idea, I mean, it's a great guy. The idea of tapestry lawns is, you know, seed trays. You basically grow a different variety of plants, maybe ayugas, maybe clovers, maybe violets or something on a seed tray. So one variety per tray. then the trays grow, and then you then take them out of the seed tray, so the root system is underneath. So they're like tiny little rectangles of turf,
yep,
for want of a better. And then you lay them out like little stitches. So that's why it's called a tapestry lawn. And then maintenance-wise, all you have to do is give it a cut once a year. So you cannot cut it, but then it will obviously become like a meadow.
Yeah.
So it would be like having a wildflower meadow, but it's actually a bit easier than a wildflower meadow because you're not reliant on the soil being poor anything like that. So, and then eventually all the plants grow into each other and become this wonderful tapestry of different flowers. And because it's incredibly biodiverse, his book is fascinating because it gives you all the different kinds of soils and what plants would suit your area. So my dream one day is to be able to go into a garden centre and instead of seeing row upon row of bedding plants, to see row upon row of seed trays full of tapestry lawn bedding.
Lovely.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
That would be lovely. I love that.
Because at the moment, there's no way to buy a tapestry lawn commercially. You have to grow it yourself, right. So that requires a lot of greenhouse space.
So I suppose a lot of the maybe some of the green roof companies could maybe take that technology and apply it to lawns.
And some of them are. I mean, there are companies that still insist on using plastic mesh on their backing, so I will not use them, but I have been working with Linden Turf quite a lot recently, and they're developing very unusual other wildflower turf companies are available but they don't have any plastic mesh backing, and they're also developing lots of different systems. So I did talk to them about tapestry lawns, so yeah, that would be great. But it'd be nice to make your own one up, actually, wouldn't it, to just sort of go with a shopping list and I'll have three of those, four of those, five of those, take them all home and
be lovely, wouldn't it,
plant them with your kids and then just watch it grow. And but so they're fine for kids to play on and roll out on, that you can lie on them and have picnics. They probably wouldn't withstand sort of day upon day of football, but they would withstand general family garden use, without doubt.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. I love that idea. What sort of can be done to change people's attitudes, do you think, both consumer and within the industry, towards artificial grass?
Gosh, now, changing people's attitudes towards artificial grass is a challenge. And I've been campaigning now, I suppose, for about 5 years. I'm quite outspoken, and I'm finding more and more probably the way I campaign may be a little bit too in your face. So I definitely think shaming people is not the way forward. And that's what I used to do. And I don't think it was the way forward. I think is not to shame, but to give people the information, I guess. We need to educate people about soil. We need to educate people about grass. You know, kids, when I was at school, we were taught about gardens and growing things. Kids aren't taught how to feed themselves, how to grow things, how to grow their own food. Growing your own food is the ultimate political act. But of course, industry doesn't want you to grow your own food because that it doesn't make money.
Yeah.
So yeah, educating, but in a non-patronizing way. And I need to change the way I do things and be a little less angry. I get quite angry about things. I see myself as, you know, the suffragette movement. You'd have the suffragettes that were quite angry and set fire to things and destroyed paintings. That's me. But then you had the suffragists who were the sensible ones and said, well, we can make Charlotte go away. Let's sit around a table and then Charlotte might go away. So maybe we continue to use me as the annoying one. And then we have some calm, sensible grown-ups doing the actual girls.
We're going to take a short break. We've no Kate's Corner this week. Instead, we're going to ask Charlotte to share some words of wisdom. What plant always brings a smile to your face and why?
My first thought is a plant called Rubus cockburnianus.
Oh, no.
You want me to lighten the mood?
And why was that? Put a smile on your face.
Because it sounds rude, and I'm a child.
Carry on gardening.
It's quite an ugly plant, actually. Or rubber, or as my friend from Wiltshire, rubbers, cockburnianus. I think it's Rubus cockburnianus if you're posh. I actually went for my RHS exams wearing a t-shirt with it because there's a guy that does root botany.
Oh, Mr. Plante.
Yeah, Michael Ferry. I shall now give you a sensible answer. Roses. I love roses. My late mother was an obsessive rose collector. She loved David Austin roses. So I love a big, fat, juicy pink rose. I love Gertrude Jekyll. Oh, I sounded like Christine Walkden just then, didn't I?
You did. I'm go Northern on us.
I'm morphing into Christine Walkden. So, I love how luscious she is. Yeah, I love Gertrude Jekyll. She's a good doer. I usually put Gertrude Jekyll in most of my garden designs because she's easy. Just like me. No. Yeah, so roses. I love roses. I know it's a bit of a cliche because everyone says roses. Oh, but yeah.
No.
No, it's lovely. Okay. Can you give us a great gardening tip that either we could act on now or in the future?
Soil. Improve your soil. And that is something you can act on now. So get in touch with your local farmer. Get some well-rotted manure. Chuck it on the ground. Leave it on the surface. Don't dig it in. And let the worms and the birds do the work. So get your soil sorted first before you do anything.
Mulch. That's Kate's...
Mulch.
Kate's subject.
My favourite word.
Yes. Mulch.
And back to the show.
So earlier in my introduction, I talked about the Women in Gardening Network Facebook group, which you started. Now people might say, well, it's just another Facebook group. But actually, it's become a bit more than that. What prompted you to set up the Women in Garden group?
I was a member of a very, very large horticultural group on Facebook, one of the largest. I won't mention its name because it's not fair, because the people that run it are actually quite nice people. But there was a discussion on there. It's sort of been rumbling in my head for a while. And there was a particular discussion, actually didn't involve me. It was somebody else. It was a lady asking about bras. And, you know, what bras do you wear that are comfortable? And, of course, it then got lots of sniggery schoolboy humour. A particular gentleman who I thought should know better. He was one of the great vanguards of the horticulture world. His landscape advice is sought by everybody, made some particularly puerile comment. And I was just enraged. So I just thought, you know what? I'm going to start my own group. And those tossers can go and do one. So the idea was for it to be a safe space for women to be able to talk about bras, periods, where we pee, all of those sort of things that we find embarrassing to talk about in mixed sex groups. But they're a very real problem for women that work outdoors. Very often we don't get access to toilets, even though we should have access to toilets. Mm. I'd tell you a funny story once when I was having to do an al fresco pee with the neighbour on the other side of the wall. I was mid-pee. I said, oh, hello, Charlotte, how you doing? I had to have this long 10-minute conversation with my trousers around my ankles because I can't pull them up. So anyway, this is the very real... This is a very real problem of being a female horticulturalist.
Absolutely.
So I started it and I knew quite a few female gardeners. And so I said, John, come and join my group. So there were about sort of 20 of us. Then it became 30. Then it became 100 and 500. And now, last look, it was about 3,100 women. And it's international. And yeah, so essentially at its core, it is a safe space for women. And I don't care what men say. If you want to go and have your safe space, I actually think men should have a safe, because I, you know, the same gentleman who made a joke about bras said that my group is sexist. But if you want to have a men-only gardening group, do, because actually sometimes men need a space away from women, and that's perfectly, I think men do need man time. Anyway, so yes, I started the group and it's just grown and grown. So it is still essentially at its core a safe space, non-judgmental. So if you're a hobby gardener or starting out, because again, there's so much snobbery in this industry and it just drives me up the wall. So I wanted to encourage women to become horticulturalists, because, you know, I was a career changer and it changed my life for the better. It made me happier and healthier. It got rid of my seasonally acquired depression, all of those things. And I'm mistress of my own destiny now. So even if you're an amateur, I want you to feel that you can join the group and take on the expertise and experience of all of these amazing, powerful, strong women. They're quite scary. Some of them, they scare me.
Definitely.
Very much they scare me, which is something, because I can be quite scary. But yeah, and I just love the way it's. And we have two rules. Don't be a dick is rule one. And the other one is do not promote plastic grass, because that's my group and I can all make up my rules. And I think Don't Be a Dick pretty much covers everything, really. And but yeah, it's really great and everyone loves it.
That's great.
I am actually a member of that group and I found it really helpful, really interesting. The one thing that's really struck me is how difficult women find to charge a decent price for the services. I know men, yes, they can as well, but it really does seem to be women, especially people who've taken some time out or like second careers or mums going back to work, trying to ask for a decent wage is, yeah, that seems to be one of the hardest things.
Yeah, and that's what I keep banging home about is that you need to value yourself. And I somebody I noticed was putting a post and wasn't charging enough. And, you know, luckily I was really pleased to see lots of the women were saying, come on, love, you're not charging enough. Come on, value yourself. Yeah. You know, we all, male and female, everybody has imposter syndrome. And I think, you know, I have imposter syndrome and I've been doing this 2 decades and I go and speak to somebody. I've been asked to go and do a workshop on how to prune blackcurrants. No idea how to prune blackcurrants properly. I'm just going to have to go onto Google and look it up because you're always learning because you have, you become focused on design and then you forget about other things. Shouldn't have admitted that, should I? So yeah, imposter syndrome kicks in. But as you say, I don't know. I don't know if it is a female thing. I don't know if men don't value themselves, but I think, you know, there seems to be a certain confidence with men that they think they're worth it or they know they're worth it, and they are, as are women.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think women think that we're weaker physically, possibly we may be, but although I've met some women that are twice as strong as other men.
Yes.
I don't know where it comes from. Yeah, and so, you know, I started a mentoring service last year, and that's always front and center of what I tell them is just charge more. Or if you've got too much work, you've got too much work because you're not charging enough. Mm-hmm. If you're struggling to keep up with your clients, it's because you're too cheap.
Wonderful. Thank you. So leading on from that, as I said, I'm part of the group and I've been following the recent campaign on the difficulties women have in finding decent workwear. And I'm a short woman, proud, short and proud. Been working in the industry for 25 years, started out as a parks gardener, and I've certainly experienced real difficulties in getting things to fit or be comfortable at all. So what led you to start this campaign?
It's interesting, actually. It's actually a campaign that I've revitalised. I actually started it back in 2019. I think it was when I was in the old house because the videos are there. So it was basically I was putting on weight, gaining weight with the menopause and finding clothes increasingly hard. I never had comfortable clothes, actually. I always had to, because I had a small waist and curvy, you know, I had an hourglass figure when I was slim. So I had a sort of small waist and curvy hips and a big bottom. So in order to find things that fitted my hips, I had to go with things with a big waist. Mm-hmm. So I was always, you know, working with bunched up trousers, and I'm 5'2" and tiny, so none of the trouser legs fit my tiny legs. So yeah, and then I was just bending down and being really uncomfortable. I was like, why did I part with this for all this blooming time? This is ridiculous. Why can't I go out and buy a pair of trousers that fit me? You know, I can go to a shop and find, you know, a good plus size range. So I'm a size 22 on my bottom half. Also, why do we do size 22s? What does that mean? You know, if you're a man, you go and buy a 32 waist, 32 leg. We don't have that in women's wear. We have this nebulous sizing range. It was best based on a woman in the 1950s who had a completely different shaped body than, because nowadays we don't have hourglass figures. Women are much straighter because of the diets, because of the exercise. And so, you know, all our sizing is based on a house model. And as you know, you go to one shop and want the size 12 is much smaller than another, and they do that on purpose.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have this against us in normal clothes, let alone workwear. And so what prompted me to revitalize my workwear campaign was a particular company who had done a campaign in the summer with thin non-gardening models. And I called them out on it, and they said, oh, no, we're going to do something with real gardeners. Actually, we're going to do a competition. And this lovely competition happened. I got very excited, and they said, wait until the winter campaign and see what happens. So the winter campaign came out a couple of weeks ago, and it was exactly the same house models. So I was like, what happened to all of that then? So I just got quite annoyed and did a post, and bless the poor lad that's just taken over their social media. I was like, oh God, no, don't. I'm going to lose my job before I've even started it. So I don't want to have a go at him because he's only been there five minutes. But but I just put that post on there and goes, can you believe it? I just put a photograph of these two gorgeous. I mean, they're lovely people. They're quite sort of, they're very catalogue models, aren't they? They're sort of, but she's a size 10 and he's a big beefy sort of outdoorsy man type, you know, with a stomach like an ironing board. Most landscapers I know have a nice beer belly. So I particularly found hilarious was they sent me a catalogue which had their women's wear section, and the photograph was a man, big burly man, holding a bag of compost, and the woman was in the background, out of focus, pushing a lawnmower. And I just thought, oh God. So I just thought I'd put it up, and then it just had loads of comments, because it is one of the biggest discussion points after charging. Yeah. Is where do I buy, where can I buy good waterproofs, where can I buy this, where can I find tools, where can I find hedge trimmers that I can lift, and all of those sorts of things, because even tools are hard. I remember I had to put cable ties on the handles of my hedge trimmers because my tiny little hands were little lady hands were too small to hold the whole thing of the hedge trimmer at once, which is really dangerous because I had to tie up the deadlock. Right. So if I dropped that, because it's impossible to hold everything together with little lady hands.
Women, even reaching the deadlock can be really, really hard. I mean, I'm like you, teeny tiny hands. And a lot of women suffer from carpal tunnel syndrome as well.
We do.
More female gardeners get that because of the tools being that bit bigger and not designed for women. One of my bugbears, I will say, is that there is some lovely workwear out there for women, but it's just so expensive.
Yes. And you know, a lot of the women in the group are single parents, they're single income families, because often they've had to come into this career, because gardening is a wonderful career to fit around childcare, because it's the one that you can do the school run, do, you know, 10 till 2 and then pick up the kids, and it is a lovely career to fit around it, but it's not a great career to be dressed in. So a lot of these women, and we're on crap pay because we're not asking enough, so we don't have £189. You know, some of us struggle to put fuel in our vehicles and feed our kids, let alone spend that kind of money on a pair of trousers.
Whereas you can go into Dickies as a man and get, you know, a good, because it's the toughness that you want.
Yes.
You know, it's great buying a pair of chinos from a woman's shop, clothing shop, but you want something that's going to last, not going to rip every time you bend down or rip on a, you know, a prickly shrub. So that's what we need,
You also want to look professional, because quite a lot of women in the group said, oh, well, I've managed to get around this because I get my stuff from charity shops, or I've got these yoga trousers, or I wear leggings, and I have, you know, my husband's shirt, and I have the leggings, and I have this. But then you end up looking like a bag lady.
Yeah.
And so you turn up to work in this mishmash of clothes. I mean, I always look like something that had been dragged through a hedge backwards.
Well, yeah.
Literally. Why can't we have professional, affordable, ethical clothing?
Is there, what do you think the industry, you know, can do? What would you like to see from the industry in response to this?
I'd like the industry to listen to us. I think now that we have this amazing, big, strong group, I think it would be, I want to, I've been talking about it quite a lot on LinkedIn, actually, in a couple of the industries that people have reached out to me. So I think I'd like them to work with our group, really. They've got a product testing case of 3,000 women of all shapes and sizes, tall, short, fat, thin, whatever, disabilities, pregnant, not pregnant, all of those things. Yes, because that's another thing. Our bellies fluctuate depending on time of the month, all of those things. So I'd like them to just listen to us and say, okay, we are listening. Here are some products, come out, test them, come back to us, give us some feedback, all of that. And I know it's hard. I spoke to Aardvark, who are one of the good brands, and they desperately want to do plus size clothes, but they can't do it because of Brexit. The companies that they used to, they can't work with, and there's no factories over here. So, you know, I worked in fashion. I know how hard it is. That's why I know how hard it is to turn these things around, the cogs. So, you know, I don't really have a silver bullet answer. We need to create the demand and ask for them to fulfill the demand, I guess. And it is expensive to have bespoke. But as I said, it seems to be possible for men to be able to choose trousers with waist and leg lengths. So why can't we?
Brilliant. Thank you so much for that.
Well, I think that's absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, Charlotte, for joining us today.
Thank you for the time.
It's been really good. I've absolutely loved hearing about the work that you're doing with women in horticulture. And I think you're absolutely right. What you're saying about women valuing themselves and valuing the time, I think that's really important. I think it's a confidence thing, I think, as much as anything. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important what you're doing there and saying to people. I think that's really, really good.
Smash the patriarchy.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, could I ask a small favour? Please take the time to like, share and review us on your podcast platform of choice. It really does make a difference and will help others to find us too. To keep up to date with the latest happenings from the Underground, head over to Facebook and join the discussion in the Underground podcast group or sign up to our email newsletter at theunderground.fm. We really do appreciate you listening, as without you, there would be no point to this podcast. And we want to hear from you. So if you have a topic or a question you'd like us to cover, drop us a line. Kate Turner, the Gardener Guru, is a horticulturalist, garden consultant, presenter and influencer. To find out more, check out her website at gardenerguru.co.uk. Phil Wright is a founding partner of Wright Barra, a creative marketing agency specialising in the home and garden sectors. And for anyone bringing a new product to market, we've created a handy 7-step guide to take your product from zero to hero. Find out more at writerbarra.com.